Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is September 12th, 2013. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. We've had the Soleri Summit for the last 2 days. Our team from all across the country has been gathered into Hickory Valley, and we want to thank you very much for those of you who sent comments and feedback. What we've been talking about for 2 days is the many different ways we can improve your subscriber experience. And I want to share one of those decisions with you. And in fact, this evening marks an historic event. This will be our last regularly scheduled live show. We're going to shift to an all pre-recorded format. The fact of the matter is that the telecommunications infrastructure in the United States has become increasingly unstable. And we feel by going to a pre-recording, we can assure the very highest quality of production and sound. And this will also enable us to produce, by the following day, a video that integrates the audio in with the slides for the money and market section, which we think you very much enjoyed with our summaries that we post on the blog called Just a Taste. So we'll be able to do a Just a Taste version of the money and market. So to make it easier for you to submit questions, because we won't be able to have the webinar software, we've added an askcatherine@soleri.com email, and we've put that email up on the resource page for subscribers. So if you don't remember it, you can just go there and find it. And we hope that will make it easier for you to submit your questions. And we've already been getting a nice flow of questions. We do have the slides up on the webinar software tonight. For those of you not listening live, you can get them up on the blog. And again, starting next week, we'll be integrating them into a video version. So you'll be able to download the audio or watch the video or read the transcript a week later. Our theme tonight is power shift. We are watching around the world unprecedented power shifts. And whenever you're in a situation where you have this much power shifting, of course, the situation becomes very fluid. The gods get warring. Certainly different factions get warring. Anything can happen. The NSA leaks that we're watching and the whole debate about internet privacy and security is really a window into some of those wars. What we're in the middle of is an unprecedented shift of financial flows, purchases, currency, new currencies, crowdfunding, new ways of financing equity capital that are beginning to now move onto the social media and online platform in a much more significant amount. It's really just begun. And that's power shifting the traditional players. They are fighting back. It wouldn't surprise me, as Dr. Farrell and I just talked about when we did our long interview about 6 weeks ago. Vatican, City of London, and are pushing back. The defense contractors are seeing an opportunity to play for turf up against the formal U.S. intelligence agencies. It's quite a fight, and it's something we're going to be watching closely for some time to come. If you haven't listened to that interview, the two-hour special I did with Dr. Farrell, I strongly recommend it as a backdrop for what's been happening. On the Soleri Report, interestingly enough, we posted our interview this evening with Franklin Sanders, who was in South Carolina. Great interview. I also got a chance, in addition to coming current on the precious metals markets, to talk a little bit about what some of the obstacles are to using precious metals as a community currency. And so we got to touch base on a bunch of very interesting topics. But one of the things that came up at one point, I brought up some of the events that are on the darker side of life. And Franklin, God love him, just said, you know, I don't like to go there. And I thought a lot about that since we talked. And I do feel very strongly that our job on the Soleri Report is to look at the darker side to the extent we need to find practical pathways to build a lighter future. And one of those favorite quotes is, deal with reality or reality will deal with you. One of the reasons I've been such a proponent of the slow burn as opposed to other scenarios of how the economy is going to unfold is because I've had a chance to look at the darker side of control. whether it's surveillance systems or invisible weaponry, UFOs, chemtrails, mind controls. Many of the topics we've explored on the Salieri Report and described to you, because I believe they're relevant to how your money and time works, and to how to watch and understand the game of economic warfare that's going on before us. I'm talking at the Casey Conference in early October, and I'm going to talk about material emissions. And I think it is a material emission for me not to look at those things, but I also don't want to dwell on them. I certainly don't believe they're the most important game in town. So we try and stay in amusement. I once had my, I was talking to a client today and they said, I should tell you this story. I was once very sort of in a dark place in Washington in the 90s when I was dealing with the worst part of the physical danger involved in the litigation. And I went to church and my pastor had worked up a whole head of steam about something and sort of screamed at us, the devil can have my car and he can have my house, but he cannot have my joy. The idea being we decide how we approach things. And I think no matter what's going on, it's imperative that we approach this power shift and the risks and opportunities in it from a state of joy, because it's through that that we're going to build the kind of future we want. I absolutely reject the vision of the future that's being created by the leadership. I have no intention of living in a police state. So I'm going to do my best to build and finance the future I would like to leave for the next generations. And that's the kind of future that I would have liked to have been born into. So I think what every one of us can do makes an enormous difference. One of my favorite quotes from the movie The Gladiator is, what we do in this lifetime echoes through eternity. And I believe that. Money and markets, the great governance shell game. Where is the money? That's our newest commentary. We just posted it today, and I want to describe it to you, but I encourage you to go take a look at the blog. This is inspired by the fact that I can't tell you how many conversations I've had over the last 2 months where somebody tells me the economy is collapsing, and I tell them, no, that's not what's happening. So I want you to just imagine 20 years ago, we had a series of systems, financial and legal systems in this country. And in those governmental systems, we had $100 trillion of liabilities and $100 trillion of assets. And then we had the financial coup d'etat, which took $40 trillion in assets and moved it over into a new entity, which we'll just call, for purposes of giving the example, the Breakaway Inc. So Breakaway Inc. now has $40 trillion of assets with no liabilities. And sitting back in the legacy systems, we have still the $100 trillion of liabilities, but now we only have $60 trillion of assets. And so the slow burn is the process by which we squeeze out the most we can from the assets, while disappointing, abrogating, or debasing the $100 trillion of liabilities. So you're trying to reconcile the assets with the liabilities, and somebody's going to get disappointed. And of course, the creditors and the beneficiaries within the legacy systems are fighting to see if, you know, am I going to get 10 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, or a dollar on the dollar? And who you are and where you are in that position is very complex. One of the things, one of my goals on the Salieri Report is to not allow you, I certainly want you to do the best you can do in terms of getting, you know, 100 cents on the dollar. However, what I don't want you to do is waste an enormous amount of time being run around the 26-step process in the system thinking that you're going to get the money, because nobody is in a position to tell you the truth. The history of politics in this country over the last century, if not longer, is that there's no political constituency yet for fiscal and monetary responsibility. You know, hopefully that's growing. I'm praying that it will emerge. But in the meantime, the legacy leadership is not turning around and telling people the truth. You know, what they're doing is they're busy trying to squeeze tax money and capital out of the tax havens. They're abrogating union contracts in places like Michigan or the different municipalities that are declaring bankruptcy. And they're trying to squeeze the state and local pension funds for more money. What they're not doing is they're not suggesting that we get the $40 trillion back because they're worried about getting killed if they should try and do that. And they're not even mentioning that it's gone, because if they were to sit down and tell you where it's gone to, how it's been positioned, how it's being invested, you know, there's still a lot of people that will laugh at you. Leaving the matrix quickly is always a stretch. So meantime, you know, before you think the economy is going to collapse, remember the leadership of the breakaway civilization is having a good time and things are growing like gangbusters. Think about it. If you look at how the defense contractor stocks have been trading, they are trading way up. They're trading ahead of the equity, the U.S. equity markets, which are certainly up for the year. And I believe that's because that $40 trillion is providing the equivalent of a new endowment that's providing them a fee flow. They're not dependent anymore on the U.S. federal government. So we have a round of sequestration cuts that have kicked in. We're expecting a new round of sequestration cuts kicking in. And yet what you can see and what you realize is those stocks are not dropping as a result of those cuts. They're trading up and things look quite good. So I posted with the article a chart of Lockheed Martin stock, and you can see it's trading well ahead of the U.S. stock market. Now, Lockheed is not only the largest overall contractor to the U.S. government, they're the largest IT contractor as well as defense contractor. Their responsibilities also include many of the accounting payment systems. So when you think about it, they not only do the work and sell the goods to the U.S. government, then they get to turn around and write the check to themselves, more than a few conflicts of interest. If you check out Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, Wired Magazine, MIT Technology, on and on and on, many of these magazines are now full of space travel. We see an announcement this week up on the blog that 200 people have now applied to be part of a one-way expedition to Mars. Aerospace manufacturing is up a lot. We have seen over the last year more than a few Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are proposing maglev trains, space companies, space mining. And when you think about it, many more billionaires under the jurisdiction of a governance system of people who can kill with impunity means pools of capital to fund those kinds of enterprises. But that's to give you an example that Breakaway Inc. is going gangbusters. They've got incredible new technology rolling out of the lab, and they are organizing and funding the next phase. And so we are watching an economy that's diverging between the legacy systems that are squeezing down and then the breakaway, which is moving up. And it almost looks like a rocket which is ejecting its booster rocket, which is falling back down to ground. So when people tell you the country is broke, what I say is the country is far from broke. The legacy systems are being re-engineered. They have been financial coup d'etat, and they are being re-engineered. It is not a pretty picture, but it's a different picture than the country being broke. And I think it's important that we have the right frame and the right story. Okay. Now, just to say that doesn't mean the new economy is going to come up and everything's going to be wonderful. In a situation, in a power shift and change this significant, anything can happen. You have factions warring. And of course, as I've said many times, the danger is not collapse. The danger is war. Yesterday was the anniversary of 9/11, an incredibly strategic event in the history of the breakaway civilization and the financial coup d'etat. Yesterday was the anniversary. We posted, as we do every year, our prayer for all concerned and involved in 9/11. A new poll for about 9/11 shows that approaching a majority of Americans do not believe the official story and are open to alternative theories. It's interesting. If you look at the Lockheed stock chart that I put up in my old articles about 9/11, Lockheed stock rose dramatically after 9/11, just as it did, just as it has recently. So interesting. Syria, what in the world is going on? Syria commanded the headlines for the last week or two. Now, the notion of invading or military action in Syria is an old one. It started in 2001. If you go back on the blog and take a look at the video of Wesley Clark describing how the Pentagon plan right after 9/11 proposed going, I believe the battle plan was the same I got at the time, which was first we go into Afghanistan, then we go to Iraq, then we go to Libya, then we go to Syria, then we go to Iran. But it was essentially the grand chessboard vision of taking control of Eurasia. Now, what in the world is going on? In fact, it's a couple things. It's important to understand that Eurasia is a very significant market share and one with tremendous growth. It's also important strategically for the pipelines planned. Big rumors this week that China had taken the lead on the TPAI pipeline, one of the biggest. China awarding grants and credits along the route. Those rumors, I've not been able to confirm them, that China has replaced the United States. Wouldn't surprise me, no matter who's running it, that Halliburton still has the lead construction contract. But so clearly the oil card and the control of the energy resources as they move back and forth, either going out to China and Asia or into Europe, is a critical issue. The other is, if we're going to come out with a new digital currency, then everybody needs to be into the central banking system under the Bank of International Settlements. And North Korea and the countries in the Middle East were noteworthy for not being in the central banking system. So part of the pressure could not just be the market share, the oil card, but getting everybody into the BIS so we can start to seriously re-engineer the currency. Now, we don't know what happened. We don't know what it was this week that was so urgent that forced Obama, using the pretext of chemical weapons, to make the pitch for us to go to war. We know there was enormous pushback, which is why he finally said, okay, I've got to go to Congress. And then we proceeded to watch the whole world pull out, or almost the whole world pull the rug out from under Obama, our British allies voting not to support whatever actions we took, many people in the military and the media not being supportive, certainly the American people, 70% or more, saying they didn't want to support the president in an action in Syria, even if there was no boots on the ground. And what we really saw was the risk of having to lead in a non-transparent world. Putin, who was really the spoiler in the mix for the Americans, runs essentially a totalitarian or a much more controlled environment. Obama answering much more to Congress and the American people during in a critical time in budget. It's very hard for him to go out when 70 to 80% of the American people don't want action and the military is exhausted from what they've done in Afghanistan and Iraq. So Obama, not able to say what the real reasons are, having to depend on a pretext, Putin pulling the pretext out from under him, has had a very bad week. And again, it's just the risk of leading in a non-transparent world. Meantime, it was a wild week in the media, including with the Syria story, because we are watching ludicrous stories and explanations of what's going on. We had in the New York Times, Friedman wrote an article on Libya and Syria, and Krugman wrote one on Obamacare that just had me rolling my eyes, thinking these people are, you know, sitting on Park Avenue having Chardonnay and are absolutely clueless how things work in the real world down in the, you know, in the streets of the country. There seems to be a real divergence between reality and Park Avenue. And it just seems to get worse. Charlie Rose did an interview of Syrian leader Assad, and Greenwald kept dumping out more revelations about the NSA and Snowden. The New York Times published an op-ed from Putin, and I finally was inspired to write a commentary that's up on the blog called "Why Are Charlie Rose and Glenn Greenwald So Lucky?" if you look at how protected they are, what they've been doing and how protected they are, when reporters and researchers who've done a lot less have ended up in prison or dead, it really begs to ask the question, who's protecting them, which gets back to what's really going on in Syria for and against. Markets, we had a very significant gold slam down this week. Silver closed today at $21.93, gold at $13.27. A critical issue was, would gold break the $13.50 line, and it did. If I continue to think the primary trend is going to reassert by the end of the year, it's what Franklin and I talked about on the interview, but I don't underestimate the ability of the markets or the managers to take the price of gold back down to the summer lows before we reassert towards the end of the year. So don't be surprised if we go on a precious metals roller coaster, and it's one of the things Franklin and I talk about in tonight's interview, which is up on the blog. A lot of trading up and down sideways. The S&P has been strong. The American markets have been strong. The emerging markets and commodities are peeking their head up, looking like they want to be strong, and interest rates have dropped back just a little bit. It's clear that the long-term bull market in bonds is eventually coming to an end here, so we're coming into a turn, but it looks like we're going to have a little respite at least with bonds for now. The S&P has still not made it back to 1700. We see a change in the Dow index. Bank of America, Alcoa, and HP getting dropped out, and Goldman, Nike, Visa getting put in. One of the things that's interesting about that is one of the things that keeps the indexes up is we keep changing what's in it. Keep watching interest rates, even though we've gotten a bit of a breather. I think interest rates, even more than the U.S. dollar, are the key variable to watch, because the legacy systems were financed with debt. The Breakaway Inc. is going to be financed with equity. It's going to be much more of an equity world. But a lot of what will go on in the sort of the reengineering and the workout of the legacy systems is going to depend on what happens in the bond market, and interest rates is the variable that's going to tell us how that's going to proceed. Fracking has come to Europe. We see stories of UK moving forward on fracking, of course, Europe resisting. It's very important. I had Justin make up a chart to show you what has happened to the price of natural gas here in the country. The United States right now is leading the world in bringing their emissions down, and that's because we're replacing coal with gas. And the tremendous, you can hate Cheney, but at the same time, if you look at what he did in terms of engineering the institutionalization or the introduction of fracking technology in this country, it's had a dramatic impact on bringing costs down, putting us back in the game in manufacturing. I'm not saying I would have done it. I'm not saying it's a good thing. But if you understand the strategic importance of bringing that price down and sort of putting manufacturing in the game, it's going to have a very dramatic impact on the economy. It's having a very dramatic impact on the economy now. It would be really interesting to think about what the U.S. dollar might be trading at if our energy costs weren't dropping dramatically like that. Other stories, and this was a week when the information was exploding. You see, as I said, space everywhere. 200,000 people sign up for a one-way trip to Mars. Goldman snubs its own employees. This is a very interesting story. And a story that will tell you a little bit about the breakaway civilization. We have Goldman Sachs saying it's no longer going to permit employees who are not accredited investors, which means they don't have a net worth of at least $1 million, invest on the Goldman Sachs private money management platform. And what that tells me is they don't want their employees knowing what they're doing, what their investment strategy is. It's kind of scary because Goldman was always smart about making sure everyone at Goldman Sachs, down to the guys in the print shop and the secretaries, feel like they were an insider, part of the in crowd. And To snub them like that, to me, is a very dangerous thing, because you're talking about 20,000 people who have access to an extraordinary amount of information. But I guess they don't want them to have access to their investment strategies. So, you know, there's trouble in paradise, no doubt about it. Another interesting story that comments on Breakaway Inc. J.P. Morgan has removed lending barriers and are starting to lend in the mortgage markets again. This is a very important signal. As I said, I believe the Fed has finished shredding the mortgage paper. They've bought up the fraudulent paper. They've shredded it. The banks are now clean of that paper and can proceed to start to lend again. Of course, now that they and their friends have picked up all the real estate cheap with all the foreclosures, as they start to bring the housing market back up, it's going to be a very different person that benefits. Another comment on Breakaway Inc. Twitter announces its IPO. Again, we're going to talk a lot more about this next week. Crowdfunding has the potential to dramatically increase social media and internet stock valuations worldwide. We're going to be doing two shows on crowdfunding this year, one next week, to introduce sort of what is crowdfunding, why do I think it's so important, where does it fit in strategically, why should you care, how will it impact you, and then we're going to do another one when the SEC regulations are promulgated, because that's really when it's going to get going. Okay, let's look at the legacy system squeeze stories, because a lot of the stories you're reading about sort of financial issues are really about that squeeze of making the $60 trillion cover the $100 trillion of liabilities. And in one sense, you can batch them all into sort of one category. Of course, we have the budget negotiations going on in Congress. And among other things, that Syria and the budget negotiations have slowed down immigration reform. This is the problem with having a system that's this centralized. Everything, the pig's trying to go through the snake. And frankly, it's too much complexity and too many political, too much political capital being demanded. So, immigration reform may slow down and may take the bite. Of course, everybody gave up on tax reform a long time ago. There's no way that can also make it through. We have a journalist in Texas facing prison over a link. He linked to things that are being said to be, you know, classified documents. He didn't publish them. He just linked to them. It's a very dangerous legal precedent. Oftentimes you'll see the enforcement agencies go after somebody who doesn't have the resources to fight. So you wouldn't do this to Glenn Greenwald because The Guardian has the resources to fight. You create the legal precedent on somebody who can't afford to fight. And then, of course, you can apply it elsewhere. So blog story is posted on that. Another story this week, IBM moves retirees to insurance exchange as costs rise. That's a little signal. As I've said many times, Obamacare created a framework so that you could start to squeeze down private and public plans. And I think it's created a framework where a lot of the healthcare benefits, both for private retirees as well as government programs, are now going to get squeezed down. IBM doing that is sort of another example, like the Goldman Sachs example of companies snubbing either employees or former employees and thinking they can get away with it. A notice coming out that the U.S. is going to simulate in November a large-scale maneuver of powers, failure on the power grid. I'm working very hard to make sure my generator is fixed, maintained, and in good shape. I've had a generator for quite a while, and I like to be prepared to go for 2 to 3 days without power from the grid. And I really recommend if you can, it's worth considering, because I think these kind of interruptions are things that can happen and might happen. Our hero this week is Pearl Fryer. Pearl Fryer is, to me, he's a gardener. Wikipedia calls him a topiary artist, but he's an extraordinary man living in rural South Carolina who just got it in his head one day that he was going to become a gardener, and he was going to win Gardener of the Month Club in his town, Bishopville, South Carolina. And he's proceeded to create and grow a garden that is, you know, I can't even describe it to you. It is simply an astonishing, an amazing, beautiful, mysterious creation that is not only loved in Bishopville, but is now probably the biggest economic development thing going in Bishopville, South Carolina. But he is a wonderful example of what one person can do to not only change the world, but inspire many people and to create economic value from, you know, from doing what's in your heart and what you love. He's also the subject of a documentary film, which we're reviewing, and Let's Go to the Movies, so I'll get back to it in a second. Ask Catherine a lot of great questions this week. Okay, one from Bob. Great call on the gold-silver knockdown. I guess I had said that that was probable that it would happen. The Fed Treasury says the dollar would fade over 10 years in 809, J.P. Morgan being long in gold and silver, and short silver, but speculatively speaking insolvent, and the Angus Fleer retracing into North America. What is your opinion of the future of the dollar? I think the dollar in the short term is strong, although I will say that the current events on Syria are not good for the dollar. The president having the rug pulled out from under him by various allies and the military, et cetera, that kind of sort of political flop is short-term bad for the dollar, as we saw it drop this morning. But I think put that aside. I think the dollar is strong from now, but part of the pressure of getting everybody into the central banking system is there's no doubt they want to centralize and re-engineer the currencies. And that has been slower going than I think the leadership wanted. In terms of the Anglosphere retrenching into North America, I think the Anglosphere is retrenching into the English-speaking nations. And if you want to learn more about that, definitely listen to the interview with Dr. Farrell. We watched the emerging markets start to turn up this week and commodities start to turn up. Let's see how they continue to trade, because I think the pullback of capital from the emerging markets is a process that's going to continue into 2014. And let's see how tough it gets in 2014 when the bond market, when interest rates start to turn up. Because when interest rates start to turn up, I think it's going to hit the emerging markets much harder. Big question is how far and fast they go. And then, of course, how far and fast we can get the crash up in the equity markets to happen, which I think is the leadership's goal. Again, if the gold and silver knockdown get down to the summer bottoms, I do believe, you know, very good chance we're going to see the primary trend reassert by the end of the year. But, you know, let's see what happens. Look to November and March to tell us the story. And Franklin and I talk a lot more about it in the interview. Okay, Catherine, I'm a big fan. This is from Steve. I'm a big fan of your intelligent, creative, and open-minded presentation on life in the Matrix. Question for you and Franklin, what events will precipitate an end to the paper manipulation of the precious metals market, i.e. the spot price? The huge paper gold dump that dropped the price below 1500 last April is a good example. Which event will most likely set the PM prices free of the paper manipulation? When will simple market fundamentals like physical supply and demand return as the major determinant of the price of gold and silver? Will PM dealers be able to break free of the future spot price rigging, COMEX default, fractional reserve banking collapse and bank runs, stock market crash, extreme PM physical shortages, backwardation, world dollar dump, any of these or something else? I think that managing the precious metals prices is a critical component of the governance system. So I don't see that changing. Once the governance system manages in reengineering the global currency, particularly if they're able to create sort of a digital reserve currency or a one world currency, the process of managing could sort of quiet down and you'll see less shenanigans. That's possible if we see a war break out and the plans for a global governance system fall apart. We could also see a return to something much more organic and market-like. But I think the notion that we're going to have one of these events, like a big bang event, cause the governance system to lose control and return to markets, I don't think that's the right frame on the situation, because I think the precious metals market has been managed for a long time, and it's a critical part of the entire governance system. And that's why I keep saying, you know, the most important question is, who's really running things? How does that system work, and how do we evolve it into a governance system that makes sense? So this is a bigger conversation about who's running the planet. But I think this notion that we're any one of these things could happen and it's going to break the precious metals market free is just not the right way to look at the story. From Maryland, according to Wall Street Journal, HUD has told Westchester County in New York that their local zoning regulations do not allow for enough diversity, and HUD will define what regulations the local counties must use in developing their communities, such as the limits on size, type, height, and density of buildings and diversity. What is HUD up to, and where do they get their authority to usurp the local community's desires regarding their right to define their neighborhoods? Is taking away property rights the next step in forcing each family to live in a community and house, HUD determines? Since most of the deeds to mortgages are held by Boston Federal Bank, will they have the power to distribute these deeds as they determine? I don't know if that's true. I'm not sure what they meant by that. If you go back on the blog, it was about a year ago, I posted a link to the new proposal from HUD as to their ability as a regulatory matter to simply micromanage everybody in this way. It's truly one of the most frightening proposals I've ever seen come out of government. It's, you know, it makes the Soviet Union look like a market economy. What is this about? If you take this and combine it with Agenda 21 and combine it with things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you're basically looking at a situation where you're creating the ability of the federal government, large investors, to come into a community and basically drive everybody into the ground with rules and regulations. So it's part of squeezing down in the legacy economy. It's part of maintaining very tight control at the top. What the sort of specifics and inside baseball on this piece is, I don't know. But it's HUD is planning on, if you look at their pronouncement of about a year ago, they're planning on doing this or reserving the right to do this everywhere. It's pretty scary. Hi, Catherine. And this is a comment from the blog on the documentary that the review I posted of the documentary on called Moon Rising. Very interesting documentary, which I encourage you to watch. And they asked if I would check out someone named Wal Thornhill and consider him for the Salieri Report. So we will definitely take a look. Thank you for that. That was from Jacques. Megan, well, we could just go galactic and say that our planet's undergoing a complete shift in consciousness, energy, and light, and that finally the truth is going to gain strength with every passing day. Maybe it's getting easier for people behind the scenes who are numbering more and more and who are in positions of power to protect those who come forward. Great comment, because, you know, there are so many people within the operations of companies and governments who are, you know, feel the way that we all do, that this is not an optimal way to run a planet. So we certainly want to encourage all of them to do the right thing and be allies. So great comment from Megan. Finally, from Kathy, a question about idea about Ellen Brown sending a link of Ellen's latest article on the importance of getting all the different, or sort of the reasons behind the Syria squabble being to get all those countries into the central banking system, and a plug for Polyface Farm. Very good. Too late for Franklin's discussion, so maybe you and Chuck Gibson will touch on inflation expectations for early 2014 during the quarterly report. I will make every effort to do that. And let's see, that's it. Let me just check the webinar software. Ooh, more questions. Okay. Given the nature of the tapeworm economy and the desire of many of us not to be a part of it, what are your suggestions about the best ways to prepare for retirement? Oh, great question. You know something? I may just do a Solari report on that. That's a great question, but I'm not going to do it tonight. I am going to try and one of the things I would encourage you to do is to listen to next week's Solari report on crowdfunding. But great question. Thank you, Michael. Joan, you've talked about the black budget and how much of the scientific innovations created over the years are beginning to infiltrate society, such as 3D printers. How does the brilliant Elon Musk fit into this? What happens when you have a wave of technology coming out of the insiders or out of the black budget? What they will do is they will pick out really capable and brilliant entrepreneurs and promote them and encourage them to lead the idea discussion. Now, it's always interesting to watch this because many of those entrepreneurs have no idea how they're being positioned and why they have the wind at their back. They're usually pretty sincere people. I think Musk is a very talented guy, and he's got an enormous wind at his back in addition to being a very talented and capable guy. And because they would much rather have those people sell the ideas than they sell the ideas. Now, those ideas can be good or bad. So I think maglev trains and space travel are great ideas. Mark Zuckerberg promoting, you know, all of us getting in there and building the CIA and NSA files on ourselves and our friends, I don't think is such a great idea. You know, so I think that Google and Facebook and a lot of these things were basically promoted as one thing when in fact they're Trojan horses and they're really something else. So Musk is an example of, you know, a great entrepreneur who's leading things that they want to see promoted and be made fashionable. You know, but we also see other entrepreneurs leading things that they're making quite fashionable but are not necessarily, you know, such wonderful ideas. So I would say Musk definitely has a black budget wind at his back, but you know, my guess is he's a pretty talented, capable entrepreneur. And if you look at the things you're promoting, I think the things that, you know, I, for one, would love to see beautiful electric cars. And I think PayPal is a great service. And I think his SpaceX is a great idea. And I think maglev trains are a great idea. So, you know, so the important thing to always ask about an entrepreneur or an idea is, does it have a positive total economic return or does it have a negative one? So I think that's kind of how I do the take. Okay, the interview tonight, as we all know, is with Franklin Sanders, Precious Metals, and it's up on the blog, and I enjoyed it at your leisure. Let's go to the movies. A Man Named Pearl, a great documentary about Pearl Fryer. If you don't know about Pearl Fryer and you want to be absolutely inspired and feel like you can, you know, you love being a member of the human race and you think the world is a fantastic place. If you really want to feel great, get A Man Named Pearl. It's a 2006 documentary and it's great. After I saw it from Netflix, I just went out and bought it because it was one I wanted in my library. Okay, that's it for this evening. In closing, coming up next week, Introduction to Crowdfunding. You don't want to miss it. It's going to be our Coming Clean interview for the month. Then John Rappaport, and on October 3rd, very big one, third quarter wrap-up. I think what I'll do is I'll answer that question on how to prepare for retirement in the wrap-up. And but if you have any other things you want me to focus in on the third quarter wrap-up, definitely send them to askcatherine@solari.com. So until next week on crowdfunding, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. As always, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Salera Report Franklin Sanders, who is over in South Carolina trying to have a vacation, but of course we won't let him. Anyway, so unusually, I'm in Tennessee and Franklin's out and about. So Franklin, welcome back to the Salera Report. We have, of course, this is the Precious Metals Report, and we have a lot to talk about.
Oh yeah, well thanks for inviting me. Diving right off the board into the ocean, I don't think, you know, there are a lot of times when you look at charts and look at markets that you're just really confused and you think, I don't know, sick 'em from come here about what's going on. This is not one of those times. It's not one of those times in gold and silver. It's not one of those times in stocks. Currencies are confused, but they always are confused because you don't know how the manipulators are going to manipulate them. But silver and gold have had a huge run since June, and right now I have to work on the assumption that the 27th of June, the lows on the 27th of June, which was about 1180 for gold and about 18, just 20 for silver, that those are the lows for the big long correction that lasted from April and August of 2011 until this year. And the best comparison to understand that correction is to look back at 75 and 76 in the gold market and the silver market. And if you remember, at the last of 1974, the first day of 1975, gold ownership was to be legalized in the United States. Now, I won't take a detour to say how stupid it is to treat gold and silver like heroin, but in any event, they did. And in anticipation of that, gold reached $195.50 right at the end of December. And then, oh my goodness, the government whacked gold. The Treasury had these gold auctions. The IMF had gold auctions. Everybody they could pull in had gold auctions to try and drive the price down. And of course, the oil sheiks who were having to take dollars and didn't want them were just as happy as they could be to buy up the U.S. gold that way on the cheap. And this kept up until, well, they kept on doing the auctions through 79, I think, but this kept up until August of 76, driving down the price. And they drove down the gold price about nearly 50% to $102.50. That was the low late in August of 76, and then it rose from there about 8.5 times, and silver rose about 12.5 times. So if you look at the sweep of the whole bull market from 1960 to 1980, gold's performance from that low in 76 and silver's performance for that low in 76 were better than anything they have turned in before, better than any period before. So I think that's what we've come through. I think this has been the big correction, sort of in the middle, not exactly in the time middle, but in the middle of the progress of the bull market. And there are several things that make me think that. If you look at a longer-term gold chart, what you see is that we're right about the place where we're at the meeting the downtrend line from those highs in 2011. And the same is true in silver. Actually, silver has crossed that downtrend line from the April 2011 high. And all those things just give the appearance of a long-term bottom. Gold has not quite gotten through that long-term downtrend line, but it's not unusual when you get, you know, when you've had that long a correction for it to take more than one try to breach an important resistance line like that. But the more important resistance in gold is 1550, where it broke off back in April. And for silver, that's about $27. So they need to get through there. The gains this summer have been wonderful, from 1180 to 1434 for gold, and for silver from 1820 to 2512. I mean, those are huge gains. And they've digested them well. And right now they're in the middle of sort of short-term correction that will take silver probably down to $22.50 or $22, and gold down to $13.50, and those are really going to be historic places to buy. In other words, right now, the next couple of days will be one of those historic opportunities where you can point back at the chart and say, "That's the place we ought to buy." Unless they break those levels. And of course, you never have any guarantee beforehand. There's more than that. Now, I'm just talking. If you want to interrupt me, please do.
Well, you know, one of the things I was going to say, I don't remember a time when among the large financial institutions there was such divergence of opinion being publicly stated about what they anticipate. So I'll give you, I was just looking at Stuart Thompson's newsletter this morning, and he's affirming what's come to me from other people in the market. SoGen, UBS, and Goldman are talking about tanking to 1250. Actually, one of them was 1200. Commerce Bank is calling for a low of 1180. Bank of America, who was critical in driving the drop in April, is a bull, saying it's up. Barclays is saying it's down. You've got a couple of others saying it's up. And if you look at the divergence of what they're expecting by the end of the year, you know, it's a massive spread. And so, you know, some are really saying, okay, we're going to test the low again. And others are saying, no, the lows are over. Here we go. So, but if you look at the, you know, sort of the large financial institutions, there's incredible divergence in terms of what they're saying publicly. And that's, I don't remember it being that, you know, sort of publicly. I don't remember the large financial institutions being that incoherent publicly. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It's almost as though the Midianites are warring again and everybody's trying to figure out who can rig it what way.
Well, I was talking to a customer of mine who manages a small hedge fund, like $500 million, $200 million, something like that. And he said that everybody he talks to about stocks believes it's a casino. They have to play, but they all think it's a casino. They can't find, you know, any rational footing for it. And I think that's reflected, that what you see happening in silver and gold is reflecting that, because if you look at the industrials, the Dow in gold or the Dow in silver, what you see is that we've had a bear market rally up through the downtrend line and slightly past it. And then, boy, they came in July and August, they came crashing down, both of those, both the Dow in silver and the Dow in gold. And silver actually moving faster than gold, back to that downtrend line. And they bounced off of that downtrend line, but it looks like they'll go back through. This is one of those places where interpretation is everything, because they might have broken out of the downtrend line and returned for a final kiss goodbye, or they might pierce it again and continue to fall. The best reason I can give you for saying they ought to continue to fall is the target, the long-term target. Once the primary trend starts in silver and gold, and stocks versus silver and gold, it tends to go all the way in gold to 1 to 2 ounces to buy the entire Dow, and silver to say 32 ounces to buy the until 16 to 32 ounces to buy the entire Dow. And when I say it tends to go to that, if you look at the history of bull markets in silver and gold for the last 100 years versus stocks, then you see that they keep returning to that price. So if they, there's something there in the market. I don't know what it is. I don't have to know what causes it. I only have to observe that it exists, like gravity of some kind. And that implies that we have a long way to go in the Dow and silver and the Dow and gold, a long way to go down. That is, silver and gold gain a whole lot against stocks. If you look at stocks by themselves, the SPX, the S&P 500 has been outperforming the Dow. The Dow has been strangely sluggish compared to the S&P 500. And that, it's obvious, I think, from the chart that they have completed the correction that began at the 1st of August and now turned back up because they've just in the last 2 days pierced the downtrend line. And the S&P is above its 50-day moving average. The Dow's not. And, the moving averages just show you which way the momentum is. When they're above those moving averages, it means the momentum is up. I think what you're going to see is another high in stocks, maybe a new nominal high, and everybody will think that's just great before they before they fall off the cliff, because we're approaching the top of a 300-year cycle, and so that's what we're going to see sometime between now and, say, the first quarter of next year, and that'll be a startling correction. If you look at what's, one of the things driving the stock market, it's not just the new money that Bernanke has printed, it's also his zero interest rate policy. The zero interest rate policy drove people into bonds, into U.S. government bonds specifically, because why should they take the risk of investing in stocks when returns are so low? It just drove people into the zero interest rate policy, drove people into bonds. The interest rate broke out earlier this year. Well, really, it started in December of last year, and it's proven that breakout. And now, both whether you look at the 30-year bond yield or the 10-year bond yield, you can see that Bernanke and his zero interest rate policy are in trouble. I mean, they're gone. Rates are going up. Interest rates are going up. They have not yet broken out of a 30-year downtrend, but they're certainly moving in that direction. So that, those rates rising don't necessarily throw the brakes on the stock market, because rates can rise when the stock market is rising. But they do make me look forward or wonder whether there'll be some kind of debacle in the bond market, because Bernanke created a bubble in the bond market just the way he's created bubbles, and just the way his predecessor created a bubble in real estate, and before that a bubble in stocks, and this bubble and that bubble. That's the way they do. They flounder from one kind of bubble. They flop from one kind of bubble to the other.
Well, let me just point out, because I kind of look at this much more politically. I tend to come at this thing from a political standpoint. And what I see is we've had the Fed, I believe, successfully pull in the remainder of the fraudulent paper that they didn't pull in during the bailouts. And basically the fraud from the financial coup d'etat is shredded. And that means we now have two economies. We have an old economy that has the legacy liability. So it's got, so I'm just grossly oversimplifying. So we have $100 trillion of liabilities in the old economy and $50 trillion of assets. Okay. So we don't have the assets we need to carry all the liabilities, and that's, you know, retirement obligations, healthcare, et cetera. And then in the new economy, we've pulled over $50 trillion, and they're doing quite fine. Okay? So now that you've got the fraudulent paper, now that you've got the money across and you've got the fraudulent paper shredded, and you're past the statute of limitations on a lot of things, so that $50 trillion is safe. Now I think the decision has been made to lower the boom. Now, the legacy economy was financed with bonds. So the question in the legacy economy, whether it's bondholders or retirees or pension fund beneficiaries or municipal unions, of the 100 trillion liabilities, who's going to get a dollar, who's going to get 50 cents, and who's going to get zero? And so part of that is the turn in the bond market, because, you know, the creditors are part of that, you know, of that 100 trillion fighting for the 50. So between retirees, union officials, and labor, and creditors, you're now going to have a war for the 50 cents on the dollar. And you're right. I think interest rates, certainly in the long end, are going to come up as part of that. And then over in this new system, you know, the stock market, I think one of the things we're looking at, it's one of the scenarios, is we're going to get a crash up, which is basically the money that's been printed is going to be funneled into a rising stock market. And there's some other things I want to talk about there. But I, you know, I'm with you, Franklin. I think the thing to watch here, to me, the number one variable to watch right now in the market is interest rates. And I think the lowering the boom on that old economy and what's going to go on in the bond market is going to be, you know, it's going to be one of the most unprecedented financial experiences of life on planet Earth, you know, for the last 5,000 years. So I think this is going to be quite, quite a scene. So to me, interest rates are absolutely the thing to watch. And one of my questions is, what does rising interest mean? What does that mean for the gold price?
Well, let me add here one little confusing thing that may bother some of your listeners. Interest rates and bond prices move opposite to each other. So what we're saying, what we're presupposing, is that everybody who's listening understands that when we say interest rates are going up, that means bonds are going to tank. Bonds go down exactly in proportion as interest rates rise.
Okay, so just because they're not going to, let me just say one thing. The impact on bond prices depends on maturity. And I think one of the things you and I probably both think is the long, you know, the 30-year treasury is, and 30-year corporates, 30-year bonds are headed up. Because one of the questions here is, I think we certainly this year we could get a situation where rates rise, but they rise a lot more on the long end than they do in the short and intermediate. So,
well, and the reason for that is,
yeah.
If you've ever had one of those old time, a bike inner tube, and you stretched it out, you know that the farther you stretch it, the more it hurts you when it snaps back. And
right.
Bernanke has done the most manipulation in the long end interest rates. And so they've got the farthest to snap back. In other words, he has skewed the market and manipulated the market the most away from where it would naturally go in those long in the long end of the market. And that's what Operation Twist was all about. And that means that the long end will have the biggest, the long end of the bond market will be the one that suffers the greatest blow from the rise in interest rates. Thinking about interest rates, you made me think about the dollar too, because one of the things that the U.S., the whole system depends on is that foreigners buy lots and lots of those bonds to recycle the dollars that they get in trade and to recycle the trade deficit. And one of those markets that's confused right now is the currency market. Now that's kind of always the case. And if you look at charts, you can see you can see that that's the case because you can see where a market apparently ought to go up, but it goes down, and then it ought to keep going down, but it goes back up. And those are the currency charts. And right now, the dollar just can't seem to get up off the ground. It had a long drop in July that saw a bottom in August, and it's gone up since then, but it's just not, there's not been much strength to it. On the other hand, the euro and the yen have just tanked since mid-August. The yen especially has broken out of an upward channel, and it appears that the Japanese are targeting 125 yen to the dollar. Now it's not there yet. It's about 100 cents to 100 yen right now, but it certainly, you know, when you break out of a long-standing channel like that, then you've got at least a target of the last low, which is like 96.5. So I can't exactly figure out what they're doing, because the yen has broken, the euro has broken, but the dollar is not taking off. So,
well, one of the questions I have watching everything is, you know, to what extent are we watching a situation where you're just seeing such a widespread fundamental distrust, you know, that it's very deflationary for almost everything?
Because so, it just makes everybody pull in his horns.
Right. I just think you're seeing, you know, psychologically translating into financial, you know, an entire planet sort of backing off in fear. You know how animals will slowly step away, you know, very slowly step away from the one that they're scared of, you know, while the predators come in to eat. And I think everybody's just saying, I don't think this is under adult supervision. I don't, you know, so when I read these different banks with wildly different projections, you know, at some point you kind of figure, well, you know, the whole thing doesn't make sense. So I think there's a, you know, there's a natural deflationary force going on that's part of what the system is grappling with.
Well, you know, and that's borne out by what happened to Draghi last week, Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank. And there were headlines within the last week and a half about his failure to contain interest rates, even the intrabank lending rate in Europe is rising. He had tried, and this has been one of the amazing things about the course of this crisis since 2008, is the success of job bombing. You know, the Japanese, if you look at what they've done to their money supply, it hasn't really changed. But they've brought the exchange rate down from about 120 or so down to, from 106 down to 100. Well, that's not right. It's come down from about, I think, 120 down to, since they announced last year that they were going to gut their currency. It's come down from about 125 to about 100. So that's a, you know, 20% drop is pretty big without taking any actual action. And Draghi had the same sort of success in Europe to keep the lid on the crisis just by talking. And now that's not working anymore.
Let's just look into the little box of the legacy systems with 50 trillion in assets and 100 trillion in liabilities. Whether you're dealing with the creditors, whether you're dealing with labor, whether you're dealing with people getting health care, whether you're dealing, you know, if history has taught us anything, it's that whether you're a business leader, whether you're a healthcare leader, whether you're a government leader, turning around and coherently laying out the reality and the options, you know, in a mature fashion and taking responsibility in that way is a surefire recipe for getting slaughtered and getting nothing done. So everybody
in other words,
who's
acting like an adult.
Right. So providing adult leadership in that situation is a, you know, zero success strategy with rare exception. You know, they're the occasional miracles. But other than that, and so I think part of the problem is you have, you know, all the leadership acting bizarre and goofy. And that's part of what people are watching and saying doesn't make any sense. Now, when I watch them, it makes total sense to me because I know it doesn't make sense to, you know, it's not a personally logical strategy to act coherently and honorably in those situations. You know, right now, the message is crime pays and, you know, and honesty and leadership won't within that, you know, within that territory. Now, if you go over to the resource rich, in the short run, it's a different story. So I think, to me, that's why it's so important that everybody listening to the Precious Metals Market Report, to the Slayer Report, you know, kind of have a picture of that, because otherwise it can be remarkably depressing to watch everybody behave in really goofy ways.
Well, what you're saying is that they just are acting to save their own hides. That's the only thing going on, is they're acting to save their own hides, to maintain their own position.
Well, I see a lot of good people in that system. Now, what happens is, you know, over the last 20 years, a lot of good people have left. So a lot of good people say, look, you know, I'm only going to be in this position if I can act honorably. And I, apparently, you know, that's gotten me killed, so I'm going to leave. So they do. And so what you have, and it's funny, Colonel Wilkerson was on the Solari Report about a month ago, great interview. And basically that's what he was describing in the military. What he's saying is our problem is the leadership rising to the fore are people who've risen over being obsequious and, you know, politics and slapping out, you know, contracts to defense contractors. And, you know, and the worse things get, the more you have, you know, the cream is not rising to the top, the cream is leaving. So how do we get reasonable leadership? And I think that the thing you and I always come back to and have come back to for years, which is if the dollar depends on this machinery being strong, and the machinery is constantly operating, you know, taking advantage of the fact that it can borrow an infinite amount of money and using that to become less and less productive, where do you get the, you know, you have a non-virtuous circle between productivity and money, and it's getting worse, it's not getting better. So you have a non-virtuous circle where, you know, normally if I'm running a company and behaving in Looney Tune ways, you know, my money gets cut off. So the SEC won't let me, you know, won't let my stock stay publicly traded. The exchanges won't let me stay traded. You know, if for 14 years I said, look, I'm not going to produce audited financial statements as required by law, that can't go on for 14 years because the exchange and the SEC will shut me down. You know, or my creditors have shut me down. Now we're in a situation where I can flagrantly, I'm the U.S. government, I can break the law all day long, and I can keep borrowing money. And I can keep, you know, paying for things with dollars because I have a military and a, you know, and a position that will allow me to do that. And so you, what happens is you go from a system that is dependent ultimately on force that is very overtly and out front dependent on force. And the problem with that is the military is exhausted from war after war after war. You know, at what point can you keep that going without some kind of, in other words, if you're really going to depend on the military, then you need the military to be organized for productivity and efficiency as opposed to slapping out the right contracts to defense contractors.
Right.
So the, you know, what we're saying is, rather than there, you know, there's a 0-1 feedback loop. You're fine until you're not, and then it's, you know, and then it's big bang.
But the economy works the same. The private sector economy works the same way as the military economy, and that is that the more you steal, the easier it is to get credit. In other words, the credit all is flowing to an elite that has access to credit, and they use the credit not for productive ends, but for speculative ends.
Well, I don't think that's true, Franklin. And let me just say, because I want to just say what I'm about to describe is not what I think is right. I'm just talking about what I think is. If I take the $40 or $50 trillion and move it over into new legal entities where it's not encumbered by the $100 trillion of liabilities, and I get an income flow of, 10% a year, but that's too high. Let's say I get an income flow of 5% a year. I've now got, I've now got $2.5 trillion a year in dividends and interest, which I can use to run essentially my private government. So I've created an endowment that can then replace, if you think the defense contractors and the military need the federal budget, we've now created an endowment that will give me the equivalent of the same, if not more, tax flow I was having before. And I'm now independent. I'm now free. I've just privatized government and a fee flow. Now, that's not to say I'm not going to try and grab as much of the fee flow as I can from the ongoing U.S. income flow, U.S. taxes. But, I'm now sitting, free and clear, and I've got the same cash flow to basically build forward. So, I think you're literally looking at two parallel economies, and one is sitting pretty, and then one is in a slow grind to reconcile the 50 to 100 trillion. And that's why, I have all sorts of people saying, it's going to collapse. No, I think the legacy systems are in a slow-moving, slow-burn kind of collapse. But you have this other economy coming up, and if you look at what it's coming up with in terms of new technology, it's amazing. And so, big question is, does that mean that the stock market diverges into sort of two groups, one that's dying and one that's coming up? We haven't talked about crowdfunding, which I'd like to just touch base a little bit. But I think, if you're looking at what the leadership that's engineered the financial coup d'etat and is engineering this sort of new economy, I think they're doing a little bit like what they did in 89, which is where you slam down credit on a whole sector of the economy, but then the stock market was strong and it made those players, it made it much cheaper. Their PEs were high. They went and bought up everything for cheap and took over market share. So my question is, are they going to do the same thing, but in a much, much bigger way? But to me, the critical issue in that new economy is the technology, because I think the kind of technology they're going to start rolling out is very revolutionary to the economy. And if they try and engineer a crash up in the equity markets, the fundamental economic productivity is there to do it for business or certain kinds of businesses. Now, it's going to be devastating. The people who are going to get their liabilities cut over in the legacy systems are also going to lose a lot of jobs, because it's not going to create a lot of jobs for a lot of folks. This is very high-tech work. So it's a picture of hundreds of millions of people being left behind.
What are you going to do with them?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. Well, I hate to be gruesome, because that's not the way I like to look at things. In the United States since 1990, the life expectancy of a woman my age without a high school education has dropped 5 years.
So you're getting into a subject so dark that I don't like to enter into it, and I've seen
right.
It. And when I say that, I'm not speaking superficially or lightly. I'm speaking from depths of research. And anyone who does the research into what I call the the people haters, the population control movement, sees that these are not idle goals that they set of reducing the population of the earth by 90%. And they are motivated by hatred of mankind so strong, so demonic, that when you read it, when you get close to it, it slaps you in the face. And
right.
your mind and your heart recoils and says it's not possible. This kind of hatred is not possible in a human being, but there it is nonetheless. And so, you know, to think of killing off or engineering a system that would kill off billions of people is not beyond their intentions, because the intentions are there. I mean, I say that having studied it for a number of, way longer than I wanted to, a number of years. So,
well,
I think
you've
seen the same thing. I don't know, but I think you have.
I've seen the same thing, but what I've also seen is I've seen many, many leaders in the legacy systems try and do the honorable thing and try and protect people. And, you know, so I'm not saying that you shouldn't always do that, but what I'm telling you is that the people will not support, in other words, every leader who tried to inspire a financially responsible solution was not supported by the people who are now experiencing their average age diminish. In other words, there was never, you know, and thousands of people have lost their lives trying, if not hundreds of thousands, trying to build a political constituency for financial responsibility. And the reality is, ugly as it is, that the majority of the people supported the people engineering the financial coup d'etat. And, you know, it's a much more complicated conversation, and one we've had, you know, in all sorts of different Solari reports, just about why the crowd supported, you know, it's the story of the crucifixion. The crowd supported the criminal, not Jesus.
I think the reason the crowd supports the criminal is because the crowd, they expect to get part of the spoils. And
right. Yes.
A system has been built where all of these people have these expectations that never were reasonable in the first place, and yet were held out to them.
Right.
And now they've reached the point where they can't, it's becoming obvious that they can't be achieved, and they'll go with any criminal who promises to share the spoils with them.
Right. And so one of the conundrums, you know, and one of the things you and I come back to is because you and I were both, each in our own way, honorable leaders who tried to do the right thing within that legacy system. And one of the things that we have both experienced is, you know, over a very long period, why a few really hold to that line and say, well, if I can't do the honorable thing, I'm leaving, and why others don't. And, you know, part of what I call coming clean is turning to, you know, everyone who's not leading the breakaway civilization, or, you know, whatever we want to call it, and say, look, we all, you know, real solutions require we all act in ways which are responsible. You know, how can we create, you know, how can we create arcs? Because getting off the Titanic or getting thrown off the Titanic, we all need to grab some deck chairs and build arcs. But first and foremost, there has to be a commitment to, you know, to whatever we want to call it, right thinking, you know, love of the Lord, the Ten Commandments, ethical behavior, on and on and on. You can't build a culture. We can't stay in the culture of force. It's not going to work because we're going to get thrown overboard. So if we're going to build a culture, there has to be a culture that has integrity, you know, towards our recognition and support of each other's rights and our recognition and support of whatever contracts we make. And that's been the conundrum that we've all dealt with. How do we create that? Because, you know, we're looking at the, you know, whether it's the legacy systems or the new economy coming up, and we're saying, as a matter of law, you know, both of these things are certainly lawless with respect to us. So where are we going to create and find law, you know? And I would say as a Christian, you know, where I find law is I'm under the governance of a God, and within that's law, but I need to find enough other people to begin to, you know, build something if we're going to do something here on earth. And to me, it's still a conundrum.
Well, the conundrum is to get people, to convince people to act. And the only place you start, you can start, is your own community. I can't rebuild the whole economy in the whole world.
Right.
I have to start my own locally, my own local community. And here's the place that love of your neighbor comes in, is that you open yourself up to risk. You say, well, look, this person is starting a business. Am I willing to take the risk of investing with him? Or this person starting a business, am I willing to take the risk of buying from him? Am I willing to give just a little bit more to him than I would give to Amazon, for instance? I mean, listen, Amazon and Walmart scare me to death. They scare me to death because the tendency is for everything to be centralized in one seller. Well, when you've got that, you don't have an economy anymore.
Right.
I don't think. I mean, because diversity, what Charles Hugh Smith calls low-level instability, competition, arguments, et cetera, at a low level, creates systemic stability. But when you go to a monoculture, when you centralize, you create systemic instability and the
right.
risk of gigantic systemic collapse.
Right.
And that's what.
Although
that's
I will say this, because I buy a lot. Well, I buy books from Amazon because I can't. All the bookstores are shut down, so I can't get them anyplace else. But I buy all the used ones. Well, Amazon bought up all the used bookstore networks. So I almost, you know, if it's available from the used guys, I buy it there. And Amazon and eBay are both centralizers, but they feed a lot of little guys. So it's less scary than Walmart. Although I agree with you, you know, I'd rather have the bookstores back. So anyway, let me. One of the things we need to build a local economy is to be able to use gold and silver as currency. You know, to this day, the only community currency I can envision really working is you just start using your coins. And one of the things I wanted to do today, Franklin, was ask you to just take a few minutes and describe some of the issues that you've seen in Tennessee between adopting, you know, just turning to your neighbors and say, okay, let's start to use gold and silver as coins. What are some of the hurdles we got to get over?
Well, the law is just schizophrenic. The ability to use gold and silver is there in the law, in that they're legal tender. But if you try to go and buy them somewhere, then they want to impose a sales tax on them, which is, in effect, putting a barrier to the use of gold and silver. Because you're not, you know, a sales tax doesn't make any sense at all. First of all, they're legal tender, and there's no sales tax on Federal Reserve notes when they're exchanged. You know, if I go to the bank and say, give me two tens for this 20, they don't hand you a 10 and change less the sales tax. So that's the biggest barrier. In addition, and I go back to the Federal Reserve, I think the Federal Reserve has promoted these barriers to the circulation of those currencies that compete with their own currency.
Really?
So,
do you think?
Well, if you look at the process of it, you know, they got the silver out first, and then they got the gold out, and then they got what remained of the silver out of the system. So one of the problems that you have to deal with is ignorance. People, and that ignorance begins with the fact that people think in terms of paper dollars. So it's always fun to go into a restaurant and pull out a silver dollar or an ounce of silver, and you owe maybe, you know, $18, and you look at the waitress and you say, look, here's a $20 bill and here's an ounce of silver. Which do you want? And, you know, you'll see her hesitate and vacillate, and she wants the silver, but she says, finally she'll say, well, I just don't know what it's worth. And that ignorance is what we have to overcome. In an electronic world, it's silly to let that be a barrier. And you and I have done all we could in setting up the gold and silver calculator on the internet. Anybody who wants to do business in silver and gold daily can go right there. And, you know, most of what I do is kind of exceptional. Most of what even I do in doing business in gold and silver is kind of exceptional. Like, you know, this is a big place that we rent for vacation every year, and we pay for it in silver. And we've paid the same amount for 4 years. Anyway, you just have to find people. You have to suggest to people, let's do business this way, and then just make the terms as you go. Because in the end, even if they take a little less in terms of gold or silver, they get more because the value of that currency is increasing, whereas the value of the dollar is decreasing.
Right. I wanted to say, before we close, I wanted to say a couple things on the equity market, because the equity market's going to be, you know, what's happening in the bond market is going to make the equity market interesting. The other thing that's going to make the equity market interesting is crowdfunding, which I think it has the potential to be a far more dramatic financial wave than I think many people realize right now. I'm going to do the Solera report next week on crowdfunding. And it's just going to be me sort of giving an overview. But to me, you know, just like first-time home buyers sort of, you know, kick off a housing bubble, I think crowdfunding could easily do the same for the stock market, just like the early tech venture, you know, led into the tech bubble. So I think this could be a very big move. But the one thing I will say is, because the last purchases I just made as an investor, tiny though they were equities. And, you know, I look at the equity market, and it's in the short and intermediate run, it's quite irrational. You know, just like I was talking about the big banks on the precious metals, it's the same. You know, it's like a battleground, and you've got all sorts of big players behaving in completely lawless ways, you know, in the short and intermediate run. But at the same time, there are great companies that are available, and I want to invest in them. And so, in fact, one of the best investors I've ever known for years has almost completely ignored the markets and just said, you know, I'm going to find and invest in great companies. He does a lot that's fairly illiquid, but, you know, he's done gangbusters. And that's because he's ignored the short and intermediate term swings and just said, I'm going to find great companies. And those great companies, you know, that's what I don't want to give up on, because I don't see how we get out of this mess without liquid equity markets. And the reality is, if you look at what's coming with crowdfunding, if anything, I think we're in for a planetary debt for equity swap. And the question is it going to be nice or rough? And my guess is it's going to be both, depending, you know, and it's going to be very quirky what's nice and what's rough. So, you know, I feel differently about the equity markets because not everybody can invest in their own business. You and I have put all of our money in our own business.
Well, I don't disagree with you about that, and I certainly don't disagree with you about finding great companies. But as far as crowdfunding is concerned, how do you get the blasted U.S. government out of the way? Because they'll come in and strangle it with regulations. Let me give you an example, a contrary example. We need to take Africa as our model. And when I say that, that may be shocking because you think, oh, Africa's chaos and corruption and so forth. Well, Africa is on the cutting edge of economic development because it is unregulated, because it is largely unregulated, and because the corruption works to the favor of development and prosperity. That is, in the United States, you've got these people, and they're either too expensive or too remote to buy off. So they enforce these blasted regulations that put everybody out of business. In Africa, you buy them off, and they're not a problem. And so you can,
right.
you can actually prosper. And
you can deal with them at a reasonable cost.
that's exactly correct. And that,
right.
I mean, now this is loony, I know, but I've been talking to a friend in Kenya, and in Kenya they have these cooperative societies called chamas, which just means group in Swahili. And what they, because they can't, the inflation rate runs from 10 to 25% a year, and they can't possibly get a positive return on their money anywhere else, people come together and they form these chamas or groups. This is crowdfunding, okay, and it's rawest form, they
right.
form these groups, they pool their money, they buy a taxi, they buy a kiosk, they loan the money at usurious rates to their own members, and all of these things can be done because they don't have to worry about some blasted regulator trying to put them out of business.
Right, and because they've created a culture, this goes back to the people, you know, rather than running around in the 26-step process begging to get, you know, the $50 trillion in the legacy systems, they've said, oh, you know, we need to take responsibility and, you know, invent our own world. And they've created a culture where the members, I mean, I've been promoting Solari circles for years. The key to a circle working is you can trust, the members can trust each other. They keep their covenants. They keep their word. So, you know, and they have the culture. You know, in a funny kind of way, Africa has a stronger culture than we do to do that. So,
a stronger community, I think.
Yeah. So I have to make a pitch for the latest Money Changer, because you've got a great spread on, you've got a great interview in the Money Changer on Africa, and I think it's really very well done. So, get the Money Changer. You know what I'll do? If you send it to me I'll just pick it up in digital form, cut out that article, and put it up on the subscriber only section.
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, I'll do that. And that'll save you getting 400 emails.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, we've gone way too long here, but this has been fascinating, Franklin. What? Any thoughts before we close on, you know, the next 30 days? Should you be a buyer or should you be a watcher? What should we do?
I think right here in the next week or so, provided that gold doesn't go below $1,350 and silver doesn't go below $22, is the time to buy. And then you'll get a rise into September or as September progresses, and even into October, probably get a peak around there off of those $15.50 and $27 areas, and then a correction into November. And then if gold and silver follow the seasonal pattern, then higher prices into December. But I think the worst is over. I have no doubt about it. And if you want to average in at a, you know, lower your average, this is the time. This is the time to buy some.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you for interrupting your vacation, and we hope you have a wonderful time and come back rested and renewed, and we look forward to talking to you in November.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
Have a great day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.